Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Kurdish fighters and Syrian rebels were in full control of the key Syrian border town of Tal Abyad on Tuesday, activists said, after pushing out Islamic State fighters. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said the militants fled to villages south and west of the city, that a large number of landmines had been planted in Tal Abyad. Seizing the town on the Turkish border cuts off an Islamic State group supply route to its main city of Raqqa to the south. Five of nine U.S.-led coalition airstrikes in Syria overnight targeted Tal Abyad, the Pentagon said Monday, while warplanes launched 16 strikes around Iraq, heavily bombing IS positions near Iraq's second-largest city, the militant stronghold of Mosul. An Egyptian court upheld a death sentence Tuesday for former President Mohamed Morsi in connection with a 2011 mass prison break. He was originally sentenced last month along with 100 others. The same court also sentenced Mr. Morsi to life in prison on Tuesday in a separate case involving charges of conspiring with foreign groups, including the Palestinian militant group Hamas. Tuesday's rulings also included a death sentence for Brotherhood leader Mohamed Badi and life in prison for other leaders. Sentences can be appealed. South Korea has reported three new deaths as a result of the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, bringing the death toll to 19 in the largest outbreak of MERS outside the Middle East. Seoul health officials also on Tuesday announced they discovered four new cases of the deadly virus, meaning there is now a total of 154 reported MERS infections in South Korea. This is VOA News. Russian President Vladimir Putin says more than 40 new intercontinental ballistic missiles will be added to the country's nuclear arsenal this year. Addressing the opening of the Russian Defense Ministry's Army 2015 International Military Expo near Moscow on Tuesday, Mr. Putin said the new missiles will be able to overcome any, even the most technologically advanced, anti-missile defense systems. The Russian president's comments came amid heightened tensions between Russian and NATO countries over the conflict in eastern Ukraine, and they follow Western press reports that the United States is planning to permanently station heavy American weaponry and troops in eastern Europe and the Baltic states. U.S. lawmakers sharply attacked government hiring and technology officials Tuesday for not preventing a cybersecurity attack that compromised personal information for at least 4.2 million current and former federal workers. "You failed utterly and totally," Congressman Jason Chaffetz told Catherine Archuleta, chief of the government's employment agency, the Office of Personnel Management. Chaffetz, chairman of the House Oversight Committee, said,
"OPM's data security posture was akin to leaving all the doors and windows open in your house and expecting that nobody would walk in and nobody would take any information."
Chaffetz ended his statement by saying how wrong they were. He demanded to know why the personal information of government workers and retirees was not encrypted after the employment agency's watchdog warned last year that it was vulnerable to cyber attack. She said U.S. technology systems are under constant attack from foreign governments, criminals, and business interests.
"These adversaries are sophisticated, well-funded, and focused. These attacks will not stop."
She went on to say that, if anything, they will increase. In an unprecedented demonstration of increased security cooperation, Pakistan's military says its troops crossed the border Tuesday and went 600 meters inside Afghanistan to rescue an Afghan soldier who was critically wounded in a firefight with terrorists. The cross-border action took place in eastern Afghanistan, opposite to the Pakistan tribal territory of Banjur. The United States and Britain have announced a new partnership to promote the education of adolescent girls, especially in countries affected by conflict and crisis. During a visit to London by U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama, the two nations announced a new partnership to increase the quality of life around the world by helping young women obtain an education. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Libyans say a European Union plan to mount a still to be defined military intervention against the people smugglers behind the immigration crisis roiling Europe will not stop sub-Saharan Africans from trying to cross the Mediterranean. They say only Western economic development assistance in the migrant source countries will help solve the problem in the long term.
That's Jamie Detmer reporting from Tripoli. Details coming up also in the news. An Egyptian court upheld a death sentence today against former Islamist President Mohamed Morsi. And an estimated 300 migrants from Sudan, Eritrea and Somalia were discovered trying to enter France. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Sierra Leone and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, an Egyptian court upheld a death sentence today against former Islamist President Mohamed Morsi and other top Muslim Brotherhood leaders over a mass prison outbreak during the January 2011 uprising, which toppled the former president Hosni Mubarak. Edward Yeranian reports from Cairo.
Judge Shaban Shami read out the decision to uphold death sentences against half a dozen top Muslim Brotherhood leaders in a move that had been widely expected. The judge had sent the original verdicts to Egypt's Mufti, the country's top religious authority, for review. Those Muslim Brotherhood leaders on trial responded to the decision by chanting slogans against the court from inside the glass-enclosed defendant's cage. The men appeared to be smiling broadly and waving their fists in a four-finger salute to symbolize defiance of the ouster of former President Mohamed Morsi and a bloody military operation to evacuate a protest camp. The Muslim Brotherhood's website condemned the sentences, insisting they were aimed at the legitimacy of the January 2011 revolution and those who participated in it. It claimed Tuesday's sentences belong on the trash heap of history. Mr. Morsi, who was elected in Egypt's first democratic election in June 2012, was overthrown by the military a year later after large street protests against him. Tuesday's death sentence against the former Islamist president and his associates is expected to be appealed. Several trials are still pending against Mr. Morsi and top Muslim Brotherhood leaders for a variety of alleged crimes, including leaking intelligence information to foreign countries. Tuesday's verdicts involved allegations of conspiring with outside groups, including Hezbollah and Hamas, to break out of the Wadi Natroon prison in January 2011. Many analysts believe that death sentences against Mr. Morsi and his associates ultimately will not be carried out. Egypt has not executed a Muslim Brotherhood leader since Sayed Qutb was convicted of plotting to overthrow former President Gamal Abdel Nasser in 1965. American University of Beirut political scientist Hilal Kashan tells VOA he believes Egypt's leader, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, will not be eager to go against the court of world opinion, which appears to oppose the execution of Mr. Morsi.
These sentences, the death sentences, I don't think they will be commuted, but I don't think they will be carried out. In Egypt, under Sisi, issuing such sentences is aimed at deterring the opponents of the regime. Sisi understands that international public opinion will not support his execution.
Kashan says President Sisi may ultimately use these executions as a bargaining chip with his opponents to find a way out of the ongoing political impasse. Egypt's constitution gives the president authority to commute sentences after judicial procedures are complete. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
An Al-Qaeda-linked group in Libya released a list today with names of those it says died in a U.S. airstrike, but did not include Mokhtar Belmokhtar, the main target of the bombing. Ansar al-Sharia's statement denied that anyone else was killed. The bombings were the first American airstrikes in Libya since the 2011 uprising that ousted longtime leader Muammar Gaddafi. U.S. officials have not confirmed the death of Belmokhtar. He was a senior leader in Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb before starting his own group known as Signers in Blood Battalion in 2012. The U.S. has accused him of leading the 2013 attack on a gas facility in Algeria that killed 37 people, including three Americans. U.S. federal prosecutors charged Belmokhtar with multiple terrorism-related crimes after the bombing, including conspiring to support Al-Qaeda using a weapon of mass destruction and conspiring to take hostages. Italian police in riot gear forcibly removed dozens of migrants from rocky shores near the town of Venmilia along a coastline bordering France today. The removal highlights a border dispute between the French and Italian governments over who is responsible for accepting thousands of migrants landing on the coasts of Italy, Greece, and Malta over the last 18 months. An estimated 57,000 have arrived in 2015. An estimated 1,800 have died trying to cross the Mediterranean in the last 6 months. Most of the migrants, African and Syrian, have landed in Italy and Greece. The EU is locked in internal debate about returning migrants who are not granted political asylum and which countries will take in those who are accepted. Italian Interior Minister Angelino Alfano has called for shared responsibility. France and other countries argue that migrants must stay in the first country they reach. An estimated 300 migrants from Sudan, Eritrea, and Somalia were discovered camping on the rocks in an effort to enter France. The French government refused them entry. Italy says those taken from the rocks will be given food and clothes and returned. In other news, the International Office of Migration says the bodies of 30 migrants were found yesterday in a land cruiser in Niger's Sahel Desert. Another 18 bodies were found in the desert on Sunday near the town of Arlit. All were apparently bound for the Libyan coast, but were stranded when their vehicles broke down. They died of dehydration. Refugees fleeing war and conflict continue to put a strain on the Greek islands. Tens of thousands have arrived by sea so far this year from Turkey, and a lot more are expected. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
Refugees are arriving every day in inflatable dinghies and wooden boats. UN Refugee Agency spokesman William Spindler gives the numbers and locations.
More than 55,000 refugees have arrived in the Greek islands since the beginning of the year. They are arriving in some 10 different islands, but the main ones are Lesbos, Chios, Samos, Leros, and Kos. They are all very close to the Turkish coast, and in some cases only a couple of nautical miles, which makes it easier for people to cross, and they have been doing so in increasing numbers.
But the islands do not have the infrastructure to cope with the new arrivals, and conditions have deteriorated.
In the case of Lesbos, about 300 people are arriving every day. In some of the smaller islands, over 100 people are arriving every day. And this is creating huge strain on the resources of these small communities.
About 60% of the refugees are from Syria. The rest are mostly from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Somalia. Spindler says they do not want to remain on the islands. Instead, the refugees want to get to the mainland and travel to more Western European countries. particularly Germany and Sweden. Many have relatives there. The routes they're taking are often through the Balkans, particularly Macedonia, Serbia, Hungary, and Bulgaria.
We are very concerned because in many cases they take great risks by going through the mountains, sometimes with the help of smugglers, who more often than not exploit them and sometimes prey on them.
Many are walking along railroad tracks, and some are reported to have been injured or killed by passing trains. Asked why the refugees are traveling to the Greek islands instead of remaining in Turkey, Spindler says,
Turkey is hosting at the moment the largest number of refugees in the world, more than 1.7 million Syrian refugees, as well as refugees from other countries.
With no quick end in sight to the wars in Syria and Iraq, the UNHCR is planning for the long term. But Spindler says the refugee agency is hoping diplomatic efforts can help.
Many things can be done and should be done. Obviously, renewed diplomatic efforts to try to solve the conflict in Iraq and Syria are necessary, but these are obviously long-term endeavors. In the shorter term, we would like to see legal avenues for refugees who are in countries such as Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan to be able to come legally to Europe so that they don't have to take these dangerous journeys and risk their lives.
He says the situation could be eased by European countries agreeing on a refugee relocation plan. The refugees arriving on the Greek islands generally are reported in good condition. The boat trip from Turkey to Greece takes just a few hours and is considered much safer than traveling the Mediterranean from Libya to Europe. UNHCR reports no casualties so far. About 57,000 refugees and migrants have made the Mediterranean journey this year. About 1,800 have died doing so. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Libyans say a European Union plan to mount a still-to-be-defined military intervention against the people's smugglers behind the immigration crisis roiling Europe will not stop sub-Saharan Africans from trying to cross the Mediterranean. They say only Western economic development assistance in the migrants' source countries will help solve the problem in the long term. Jamie Detmer reports from Tripoli.
Italy's Prime Minister Matteo Renzi announced Monday he will ask the European Union to set up migrant processing camps in Libya to help abate the migration crisis roiling his country and impacting the whole continent. Italy is struggling to accommodate a wave of migrants crossing the Mediterranean from Libya, and France, Austria and Switzerland have started to send sub-Saharan migrants back to Italy if they first entered Europe there. Renzi says Europeans must share the burden and migrants should be distributed fairly across the continent. But the various European plans being discussed, including a still-to-be-defined military intervention to disrupt the people smuggling trade, is prompting derision in Libya and claims the Europeans do not understand the scale or complexity of the migration. Jamal Zoubia is the head of the foreign media department of the Tripoli-based government, one of two governments locked in a power struggle in Libya.
They don't want to understand this. I mean, when they say, well, we are going to hit the infrastructure, what infrastructure we have? These fishing boats, or they will hit the rocks where the fishing boats are?
The European Union has asked the UN Security Council to endorse a military mission to combat people smugglers. Neither the government in Tripoli nor the internationally recognized government that fled the Libyan capital last summer and is now based in the country's east are prepared to give consent. In 2014, an estimated 170,000 people crossed the Mediterranean from Libya. European officials fear the number this year could climb much higher without robust interdiction. Altiha Mohamed Makni is a member of the Tripoli government and comes from Libya's desert south. He says European countries have money and should be helping the migrants' source countries to develop and invest in projects in sub-Saharan Africa. That would help to deter migrants from leaving, he argues. But he does think Libya should establish migrant detention centres in the south of the country and not on the coast. Once the migrants reach the seashore, it is too late, he says. But he says one of the biggest challenges is to persuade Libya's neighbours to facilitate the deportation of migrants from Libya. The neighbouring countries the migrants have passed through must allow us to deport them back through the same route, he says, but they block this happening. Libya is on the verge of bankruptcy after a year-long civil war and standoff between rival governments and does not have the money to fly the thousands of migrants back to their home countries. Jamie Detmer for VOA News, Tripoli.
You were listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Twenty-one past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. An Egyptian court upheld a death sentence today against former Islamist president Mohamed Morsi. And an estimated 300 migrants from Sudan, Eritrea, and Somalia were discovered camping on rocks in an effort to enter France. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. President Muhammadu Buhari of Nigeria is expected to meet next week with officials of a major global corruption watchdog to learn how to stem the flood of lost oil revenues. Newly elected President Buhari, or Vice President Yemi Osinbajo, is scheduled to meet Claire Short. She's the head of the Extra Active Industries Transparency Initiative, EITI, on Monday in Abuja. Mr. Buhari made an election pledge to fight government corruption. The EITI, which is based in Oslo, Norway, said the government needs to recover more than $7.5 billion lost between 1999 and 2011. Corruption charges have plagued the Nigerian government for years. Former Nigerian Central Bank Governor Lamido Sanusi was dismissed 2 years ago after testifying about the loss of $20 billion in oil revenues between 2012 and 2013 by the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation. In other news, 10 people in the town of Potiskum in northwest Nigeria died yesterday afternoon when two suicide bombers attacked the offices of a citizen self-defense force and an outdoor cafe. More than 100 have died in suicide bombings in the region in recent weeks. Boko Haram is presumed behind the attacks on civilians and military facilities. The Nigerian army claims to have pushed the insurgent Boko Haram out of most communities in the northeast of the country. As Nigeria and neighboring countries debate the leadership of a military task force and how to fight Boko Haram, Bring Back Our Girls campaigners are pressing Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari to rescue girls kidnapped by the group and end the insurgency. Muhammad Yusuf reports for VOA that Bring Back Our Girls members will soon meet with Mr. Buhari.
What are we demanding?
Bring back our girls now and alive!
What are we demanding?
Bring back our girls!
The cry rings out of the Unity Fountain Park in central Abuja. The cry of Nigerian parents, relatives and campaigners of the Chibok girls who were kidnapped by Boko Haram more than a year ago. More than 100 people met to discuss issues surrounding the kidnapping of the 219 girls.
What are we demanding?
They have met in this park for more than a year. The group's leaders say President Muhammadu Buhari has responded to a letter they sent last week, and he will be meeting them soon. Bring Back Our Girls campaigner Hadiza Bala Usman says there are several issues to address.
One being the status and the rescue of the girls, making inquiries about ending the insurgency, where we at in terms of accountability on security spending. We have a document called the Citizens Solution to End Terrorism, which is a collation of information that was drawn across citizens, which will be presented to him.
Nigerian media reports President Buhari met with 10 parents of the missing girls last week before he left for African Union Summit in South Africa. Nigeria, Chad, Benin, Niger and Cameroon have called for a united front to defeat Boko Haram. The militants have been launching attacks in and near northeastern Nigeria since 2009. Amnesty International says Boko Haram has abducted at least 2,000 women in Nigeria since the start of 2014, forcing many into sexual slavery and armed combat. Amnesty says men and boys are regularly conscripted or executed. Reverend Mark Enoch had his biological and adopted daughters kidnapped in Chibok. He fled when Boko Haram threatened him.
Really, life has been so bad. Life has been so bad. I lost my daughter and I lost my office. I lost my properties. And really, the former Northeast is not steady. The university there has been closed. All schools have been closed. And we are forced to leave our own motherland. We are now as refugees in Abuja.
Dr. Perigino Birama joins the group in the park for the first time. He says it is good for people to be involved.
The physician is only healing one broken limb at a time. But then there's somebody on this side bombing and breaking 100 limbs at a time. So at the point you have to look at it, and each one of us has a unique skill. And I believe we should never just be fixed into our little profession. We should all be involved at some level in government.
Usman says the meeting with President Buhari will mean little if it does not result in action.
What matters to me is the outcome of the discussion. What matters to me is if it translates into an actionable activity where the girls are rescued, where the insurgency is brought to an end. Meeting him would reiterate the fact that citizens are agitating for the end of the insurgency.
In April, President Buhari said he could not promise authorities will find the 219 kidnapped Chibok school girls. For more than 420 days, the voices of Chibok girls, parents and campaigners have been raised. Their persistence and determination has given them a chance to pass their message to the president in the hope that girls and others in the hands of Boko Haram will be rescued. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Abuja.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Yiswuhi in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's up, Africa? It's Jackson Vunganyi.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Cape Town.
Can I be upfront with you? That's exactly what Nadia and I plan to do every Wednesday at 1730 UTC. Upfront looks at issues that affect you.
Since the world is moving at a faster rate, there's need to have a major computer.
Interesting news.
Canadian man was sentenced for drunk driving after being pulled over in his mother's motorized wheelchair. 35-year-old man was fined and placed on probation.
And of course, music. No clouds in my stones. Entertainment, celebrities, you name it, we'll talk about it.
And of course, we love to hear from you. Send us your thoughts and comments. Our email address is upfront@voanews.com.
So don't forget to check us out every Wednesday at 1730 UTC on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga.
Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. An Egyptian court today sentenced former President Mohamed Morsi to life in prison on charges that he spied for Hamas, Lebanese militants, Hezbollah, and Iran. An estimated 300 migrants from Sudan, Eritrea, and Somalia were discovered camping on rocks in an effort to enter France. And President Muhammadu Buhari of Nigeria is expected to meet next week with officials of a major global corruption watchdog. Coming up, music from Sierra Leone. And in our feature segment, psychosocial support for Ebola workers and survivors in West Africa. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the Sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Hello, Yehiz.
Sunny, I understand Women's World Cup football gets top billing again this evening.
Yehiz, let's kick off once again with the Women's World Cup football tournament in Canada. Tuesday night's action features the last round of matches in Group C and D. In Group C, reigning world champion Japan will take on Ecuador, who have looked overmatched, while Cameroon, who have impressed in their Women's World Cup debut, will play Switzerland. The winner of that game will advance along with Japan. In Group D, aka the Group of Death, Australia and Sweden will battle for a spot in the knockout stage, while group leaders USA play Nigeria. Now, the Super Falcons will need to defeat the Americans by at least two goals and hope for a low-scoring draw from the Aussies and the Swedes in order to claim second place in the group and ensure their advancement. But even if that plan goes awry, Nigeria could still advance as one of the top four third-place teams as long as they beat the USA and get favorable results from the final games in Groups E and F. The chances of Nigeria reaching the knockout stage for the first time since 1999 may seem slim, but the American women have been out of sorts so far at this World Cup, and the Nigerian ladies have the talent to score an upset. The Super Falcons will be without defender Ugo Njoku, who was given a three-match ban by FIFA's disciplinary committee for elbowing Australia's Sam Kerr in a match last Friday. Monday was an exciting day at the Women's World Cup, with the final round of matches in Groups A and B. The host country was determined to advance and did so in style, as a one-all draw with the Netherlands gave the Canadian ladies 5 points and made them group winners. The Steel Roses of China eliminated New Zealand with a two-all draw that sent the Chinese through to the next round with 4 points, good for second in Group A. The Germans continued their dominance in Group B with a 4-0 win over Thailand that sends them through to the next round, while Ivory Coast finished off its first-ever Women's World Cup with a 3-1 loss to Norway. The Norwegian ladies finish in second place in Group B with 7 points and join Germany in the next round.
The Voice of America.
Joining us once again on the Sunny side of sports is David Legg, our African football guru. Good evening, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
Big weekend in African Nations Cup qualifying for Gabon 2017, David. There were 25 qualifiers played across the continent. Let's go group by group and get your thoughts. In Group A, in the most lopsided match of the weekend, Tunisia trounces Djibouti 8-1, and Togo defeats Liberia 2-1. Your thoughts, David?
Yes, I mean, unfortunately for Djibouti, no surprises there. They've conceded 9 in Kenya in the past, and they've also conceded 8 in Malawi. The Tunisians, the most significant thing, I suppose, Sonny, is that Yassin Chikawi, the captain, he scored 3 goals. In fact, among all the goals, he was the only individual to claim a hat-trick. Sadly, Djibouti just outclassed in Tunis. But the one thing I do hope is that they don't consider withdrawing. It's something that used to happen in the past in Cup of Nations. The only way they're going to improve is to keep at it, and we've got to give them encouragement. The good news is their next match, which is in September, will be a home fixture against Togo. Now, Togo had to come from behind to beat Liberia 2-1 in Lome, and there was a bit of a fairy tale story here in that Emmanuel Adebayor scored the winner after 87 minutes. Now, Adebayor, as I'm afraid is the usual case with him, he pitches up in Togo. He doesn't attend the training sessions. He's dropped from the squad. He then goes and watches Togo losing 1-0 to Ghana in Accra in a friendly. He obviously suddenly got a feel for playing for the national team again. He was reinstated, and up he pops, not for the first time, Sonny, to prove the match winner for the Togolese Sparrowhawks. A crucial win, that, really, for the Togolese. If they're to have any hope of challenging Tunisia for top place, they need to win their home matches. So at the top of the table, Sonny, is Tunisia and Togo with 3 points each, but Tunisia well ahead because of that great goal difference of +7. And looking ahead to the fixtures in September 4, 5 and 6, it'll be Djibouti against Togo and Liberia against Tunisia.
Turning to Group B, David, Angola with a big 4-0 victory over Central African Republic, and in Kinshasa, the Democratic Republic of Congo edges Madagascar 2-1. How is this group shaping up, David?
Well, this one's interesting, Sonny, because Angola, they've been really on the downward slope for some time now, just casting back a little bit. In 2008 and 2010, they reached the quarterfinals of the Cup of Nations, but since then, they've been on a slippery slope. And it's nice to see them back in good form. Although I would caution, Sonny, I did get a chance to watch a fair amount of that game against the Central African Republic, and the visitors were bad to awful. Gelson scored twice for the Angolans. I just love these Angolan names. Dolly Menga, he scored another one of the goals from a penalty. And then the veteran, Gilberto.
Voice of America!
Voice of America listeners who've been following African football for some time now will well remember Gilberto. He and Flavio played for the great Al Ahly team between 2005 and 2008, when the Cairo club won the Champions League 3 times and finished runners-up once. Well, he's still going strong. It looks like he's well into his 30s now. He scored a penalty 8 minutes into stoppage time and then celebrated by running over to a motorbike, sitting on it and doing an imitation of revving the bike. Something, Sonny, I haven't seen before. You know, Africans are absolutely superb when it comes to celebrations. They've come up with a lot of original ideas down the years. I think of Roger Miller going back to 1990, going over to the corner flag and doing his own particular dance. But this was a new one on me, Sonny, sitting on a motorbike and pretending to rev it. Well, let's hope that the Angolans are revved up for future matches. The other result was an interesting one, too. Democratic Republic of Congo 2, Madagascar 1. Now, DR Congo, they finished third at the 2015 Cup of Nations. And Madagascar really impressed me at the recent CASAFA Cup, the Southern Africa Championship. And Madagascar got great practice there. They played 6 matches. They won 4, drew 1, and lost only 1. And they were really good going forward, but perhaps a little bit suspect at the back. And I think, despite the fact that they lost 2-1 in Kinshasa, they will be very encouraged by this result. And Vombola, who scored 5 goals to be the leading scorer at the CASAFA Cup, he got another one. But unfortunately, it turned out to be a consolation goal because Ndombe and Kimwaki had already scored for the Congolese. So I feel encouraging signs in defeat there, Sonny, for the Madagascans. The Angolans topped DR Congo on goal difference, and looking ahead to the match day two fixtures, Central African Republic will get a chance to redeem themselves when they host DR Congo. And then, to me, a really interesting match, Madagascar against Angola in Antananarivo. Now, if the Malagasy revival is going to gather some steam, then they'll be looking for a victory over Angola.
Turning to Group C, David, Mali playing at home defeats South Sudan 2-0. And the other group match ended in a one-all draw between host Equatorial Guinea and Benin. Your thoughts?
Sonny, I expected Mali would beat South Sudan by more than two goals. The South Sudanese, very new to international football, and in the previous qualification tournament, they took a 5-0 drubbing away to Mozambique. And remembering that Mali are quite a strong team, unlucky not to reach the quarterfinals of the 2015 Cup of Nations, I thought maybe they'd get three, four, even five goals. But they had to settle for two. Maiga after 17 minutes and Salif Koulibaly, one of three Koulibalys in the Malian defence, he scored a second after 28 minutes. So at that stage, with about a third of the match gone and the Malians two up, I'm sure their supporters were saying, yes, we can score a lot of goals. But the goals dried up, and I would say moral victory there perhaps for South Sudan, containing Mali to two goals in Bamako. The other match, to me, a surprise. I would have gone for Equatorial Guinea to win at home, given the fact that they did well in the recent Cup of Nations, which they hosted, and they finished fourth. They actually had to come from behind to draw 1-1 with Benin. Sessegnon, who plays for West Bromwich Albion in the English Premier League, he put the Benin side ahead on the stroke of half-time. And then Insu equalised 3 minutes into the second half. He's also English-based. He plays for what they call the Championship side. That's the second tier. He plays there for Middlesbrough. So to me, that's a point won by Benin and 2 points dropped by Equatorial Guinea. By dint of their victory, Mali are ahead with 3 points. And in the next round of fixtures, Benin will host Mali and South Sudan will be at home to Equatorial Guinea.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg. And David will be back later this week with more Nations Cup qualifying analysis. Finally, in African athletics, two-time world indoor champion Genzeba Dibaba of Ethiopia says she'll return next month to the place she describes as her second home, the Swedish city of Stockholm. Genzeba will compete in the women's 5,000 meters race in the Stockholm Diamond League meet July 30th. The Ethiopian star has set two world indoor records in Stockholm. And speaking of world records, Genzeba's older sister, three-time Olympic champion Tirunesh Dibaba, holds the world record at 5,000 meters. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to you, Hayes Wuhib.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Friday, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 17:30 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Some Ebola workers and survivors in West Africa are in need of psychosocial support resources, which are already hard to find in Ebola-affected countries. Louis Jules Hansen is a spokesperson for the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society's Reference Center for Psychosocial Support. She tells Ricky Shryock some support is already being offered to burial teams in the Ebola-affected countries.
They are doing activities for the Red Cross, Red Crescent, mainly Red Cross in those countries. For the volunteers who are working in the Ebola situation, especially for the volunteers who are doing safe and dignified burials, because this is very, very difficult work. It's dangerous and they are experiencing a lot of stigmatization. The national societies in Guinea and Liberia and Sierra Leone have activities for these volunteers. And it would be something like having having them come together after the end of a shift and sit down and talk. It's not a psychological debriefing like you would sometimes see in Western situations where you have this structured way of going through exactly what happened and in quite a lot of details. We don't recommend that.
Why not, may I ask?
What it boils down to is that this is something that has been done for a lot of years, and newer research has shown that it's not the best way of doing it, and in some cases it may actually be harmful.
Someone else from the Red Cross mentioned to me a specific example of a burial worker who was having very bad nightmares. They eventually actually went to a traditional healer in the area, and they were very skeptical at first, but the nightmares went away afterwards. Are there any of these traditional methods being used or being recommended? How is the Red Cross working with traditional medicine and traditional healing in these areas?
I can't give you specifics on how exactly they're working with the traditional healers, but when we talk about psychosocial support, it's very, very important for us to underscore of taking in local customs. You can't come in with a Western concept of this is how we're going to do it, this is trauma, this is psychiatric diagnosis, so this is how we're going to do it. You have to go in and see how does the local culture look at these things, what are the coping mechanisms that's already in the society, and work with those, because otherwise you're going to set yourself up for a big fail and you're not going to help people.
What are the risks of not treating trauma?
We know that in populations that have experienced trauma or disasters, we have a higher prevalence of mental health problems. That we know.
How does it impact society?
If a lot of people are suffering and are not getting any help, then it will impact the way that your local community is working. Your kids' friends may not be doing well in school. There may be problems in school, which will impact your kid. Your co-workers may not be coping very well. That will impact you. So that's on the more personal level. On the more societal level, you will have people who are feeling bad and who may be reacting in ways that are not very good for themselves and for their families and for society. And it will impact on a more community level.
Louis Jules Hansen is spokesperson for the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society's Reference Center for Psychosocial Support. She was speaking to Ricky Schreyock from Copenhagen. The increasing number of homeless street children in Western Bahr el Ghazal state has prompted officials to propose spending 32,000 South Sudanese pounds on a new survey identifying the factors that cause child homelessness and to develop recommendations for addressing the problem. Others say another survey is not what's needed. Dimo Silva Aurelier has more for VOA News from WOW.
Seeing scores of homeless children wandering the streets is nothing new in Western Bahr el Ghazal state. A 2012 survey conducted by the Western Bahr el Ghazal Ministry of Gender found that some 400 children regularly roamed the main markets of WOW town. 3 years later, that number has swelled to more than 1,000. Officials say children leave home because there is no food there. Past attempts to reduce the number of street children in WOW have failed. Officials say the new survey should determine whether the resolutions made in 2012 were ever addressed. Mary Carlino is Western Bahr el Ghazal's information minister.
وسم ناقش المجلس ايضا مذكراتها الثانيه المتعلقه بتصديق مبلغ مقدار
She says the council of ministers wants to spend 32,800 South Sudanese pounds on another survey about street kids in WOW and has asked the Ministry of Gender, Child and Social Welfare to review earlier surveys. Western Bahr el Ghazal Gender Minister Neema Abbas says the country's ongoing crisis is the biggest reason children are leaving their families. They think they will find better prospects living on the streets. She says street children beg for leftovers from restaurants or even grab food from market stalls if they are desperate enough. Father Sonel Oratel works with the Don Bosco, a church institution, as a director. He formed a center where some street children have been accommodated. but lack of space has limited his ability to take care of more children. Oratel says state authorities have no clear policy to address the disturbing phenomenon and says past survey recommendations did not stop the problem. He says the center receives support from UNICEF.
In the daycare center, they come, they have a compound to stay, to take bath or to use toilets. We provide them one meal in the evening. Then we provide the medical care. When we began, practically every child had a big wound on the legs or on the hands. With the medication, most of them got cured. We give them a facility for recreation, taking bath, hygiene programs, and also some alphanumeric classes, which did not find much success since we did not have a real setup and a place.
Father Oratel says social issues such as financial problems have contributed to the problem.
The main factor is what they bring them to town. First is the poor family fabric, probably because of polygamy or children belong to the clan or to the community. There is no real relationship to the biological father or mother, and they are free to be fed from any of the community homes or relatives. I believe second reason would be poverty, lack of educational facilities, lack of basic human necessities at home.
State officials say most attempts to reunify these children with their families have failed. In 2012, UNICEF collaborated with the state government to reunite nearly 200 of street children with their parents and provided some food, hoping the support would make them stay home. Not long afterward, many returned to the streets. Father Oratel says some parents refuse to let their children come back, most likely because they cannot provide for their basic needs. UNICEF warned this week that the lives of about a quarter of a million children in South Sudan are at significant risk as food security deteriorates due in large part to the uptick in the fighting between government and rebel forces, particularly in the Upper Nile region. UNICEF says the number of people facing severe food insecurity has almost doubled since the start of 2015, from 2.5 million to an estimated 4.6 million people, including nearly 900,000 children under the age of 5. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Wau.
And we'll be closing out the show with some music. Here is All Out of Sierra Leone with AAO.
Flow. Move your body, girl, you the one like a snake. While they rap, baby girl, now the dance flow. Move your body, girl, you the one like a snake.
Hey, hey, oh. Baby girl, with the beauty, where they make you dance. Hey, hey, oh. I'm set up for show, make you see where they make you dance. Hey, hey, oh. Baby girl, with the beauty, where they make you dance. Hey, hey, oh. I'm set up for show, make you see where they make you dance.
I want for making move your body, move, move, move your body. Don't move on, go up, shake and back, come down. Yeah, with the rock your body. Rock your body, sure. If I'm beaten like never before. For the girl them, demand them. The dreams think I'm for take over. Put your hands up, I not the aim. Uh-huh. And I know say, you uh-huh. Never ever ever tire.
I don't fuck, say look now, me head don't block. The way you the dress, now the way we the talk. DJ play the song, make me go non-stop. From night till the morning, the door, no the lock. Die day, some man say die no day. I look around, say no sign no day. But try day, I pass here, yeah, no way, no way. Tony Flex, Arayaji, man, and Lil J.
Hey, hey, oh. Baby girl with the beauty, where they make you dance. Hey, hey, oh. I'm set up for show, make you see where they make you dance. Hey, hey, oh. Baby girl with the beauty, where they make you dance. Hey, hey, oh. I'm set up for show, make you see where they make you dance.
So what is rap, baby girl, now the dance flow. Move your body, girl, you the one like a snake. While they rap, baby girl, now the dance flow. Move your body, girl, you the one like a snake.
Hey, hey, oh. Baby girl with the beauty, where they make you dance. Hey, hey, oh. Set up for show, make you see where they make you dance. Hey, hey, oh. Baby girl, where they make you see where they make you dance.
they make you dance. I said I'm for show me the thing where they make you dance.
Nigeria the rap stamp not for grab and clap. With a kick up tonight, even if it's crap. Holy girl, I gonna make you do your two step. Show the other one them say, not regret. Make you dance, make you sweat, no go regret. Come on, I don't puff, puff, like you cigarette. In the J, Sarah, I J-Man, no so rookie. You the act like Bobo, gonna host that you not be. We give them R&B, we give them hip hop. The one that with the talk, now them what you zip up. Show me the thing, we make you move like a snake, man. Me and you tonight, the rules then they break, man.
Hey, hey, oh. Baby girl, we the beauty where they make you dance.
Hey, hey,
I said I'm for show me the thing where they make you dance.
Hey, hey,
baby girl, we the beauty where they make you dance.
Hey, hey,
I said I'm for show me the thing where they make you dance.
So what is rap? Baby girl, now the dance flow. Move your body, girl, you the one like a snake. What is rap? Baby girl, now the dance flow. Move your body, girl, you the one like a snake.
Hey, hey, baby girl, we the beauty where they make you dance.
Hey, hey,
show me the thing where they make you dance.
Hey, hey, oh.
Baby girl, where they make you dance.
Hey, hey, oh.
I said I'm
gonna
show me the thing where they make you dance.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It is all well and good to have legal guarantees of human rights, including freedoms of speech, assembly, and religion. But without the legal institutions to enforce such rights in the communities where most people live, these rights rarely become reality, said U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, Tom Malinowski. In many African countries, access to justice is hampered by too few courts and legal professionals, too long a distance between communities and institutions of justice, too little knowledge about the content of the law, and by corruption that breeds distrust of the justice system. Mali, for instance, has 300 lawyers for a population of 15 million. The majority of them live in Bamako, so despite laws providing for free legal aid, if you're a poor person up country, you don't have much of a chance to get it. That's why the United States is supporting the African Center for Justice and Mobile Courts. The interconnectedness of the world means that even people in remote and impoverished areas have a greater sense of their rights. A case in point is a widow and mother of three young girls in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. After her husband's death, her in-laws threw her and her children out of their home. The mother found her way to a legal aid clinic that was able to point her toward Congolese laws supporting equal treatment of male and female children. And with the clinic's help, she and her daughters were able to return to their home. Access to justice doesn't just mean access to courts, said Assistant Secretary Malinowski. It means access to information and to government services from a government that is responsive to their needs. And the most responsive governments are those that are freely elected by citizens and that respect term limits in office. The United States wants to see systems of governance and justice that focus on citizens and that work for and empower the poorest people in society. This is the right thing to do. It's also the smart thing to do if you want to build stable, peaceful, prosperous, and just societies.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.